This is Mary Richards. Because of technical mishaps during last week's airing of the Community Bookshelf, one program was begun twice, one was not heard at all. This week we are backing up and playing those segments in the correct order. That will mean that you will listen to one repeated segment, but please accept our apologies and bear with us. Enjoy the program. Hello, I'm Mary Richards, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which can be heard every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. We are reading Deborah Marquardt's Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We rejoin the story as Deborah is telling about her childhood and her mother's nest egg of silver dollars that she saved from her job in town. For years, whenever customers paid her with a silver dollar, she would exchange it in the till for her own paper dollar, then bring the heavy coin home to the coffee can. Here was the silver cash that would save us when the next depression hit. Is it surprising that as a teenager I smuggled many of those silver dollars out of her closet and took them to town, where I exchanged them for cigarettes, French fries, and multiple pinball games? I liked the way those coins filled my palm, their solid weight, and I loved the satisfaction of spending them, the translation of the saved thing into a fluid, living experience. I can still see myself as a teenager, a skinny punk in the rec hall, slamming and rocking the pinball machine, a cigarette resting sideways on the glass so the ashes would fall to the floor, or leaning back with a pool cue in one hand and a cigarette in the other, inhaling and exhaling my mother's nest egg into smoke. How my fiscally conservative mother came to be the beneficiary of Aunt Emma's extravagance is not clear to me, but I do recall one day when we were all teenagers that a box came in the mail for my mother from California, full of Emma's hand-me-downs. Inside were spiked heels in Easter egg colors and veiled hats, fancy lined dresses and tailored jackets. But the one piece I remember best was a sleeveless sheath made of a caramel-colored boucle with filaments of gold running through the weave. When you undid the long hidden zipper in the back, you could see the dress had a gold lining and a lush label with the designer's name scripted at a chic angle. I can still see my mother spinning like a fashion model in the middle of the living room for us girls, the dress hugging her svelte figure, which was trim, not from dieting, but from hard work. The dress hung just as elegantly on a hanger in her closet for years, untouched, along with the unused accessories, a sleek gold clutch with a fancy clasp, the slim gold leather belt, and the gold, pointy-toed, 3-inch spikes. We girls might have dared to try it on when Mother wasn't around, but it seemed to emit a humming, glowing force field that kept it pristine in its isolated corner of my mother's closet. How might my mother have worn such an outfit in our small town, where the slightest difference in dress or manner marked you as unter acht und bann, an outsider, the one who does not belong? And now I wonder how my mother disposed of the dress. It wasn't as if she could have included it one year with all the other hand-me-downs at the church rummage sale. It was too beautiful to rip apart, and it wasn't made of the right material to be used for rags. It would be hilarious to find a 3-inch square of it in one of my grandmother's quilts, woven in with all the other 3-inch squares of cloth from my third-grade Easter dress and all the other handmade dresses worn by my sisters as we were growing up. These quilts were like family history lessons, mosaics with one overarching theme of riotous sameness. Finding swatches of Emma's caramel-colored boucle dress woven into one of my grandmother's quilts would be as fantastic as imagining Emma herself stepping out of a limousine on our small main street, Bacall-like, in dark sunglasses, and asking the driver in a husky voice to please bring along her steamer trunks. To some, the fact that Emma sent the fancy dresses to my mother testified to the fact that she was fully bats-in-the-belfry insane, or completely unaware of how unlike us she had become. Either way, she was too far out of our circle to be reclaimed. She was lost to us. She left North Dakota in the hard, brown days of the 1930s, and she never returned. The photographs that came from California were full of sunny streets, with Emma posing in front of downtown storefronts, with her arms thrown around another handsome soldier. There was never a husband in the pictures, just lots of different men whose last names my grandmother never knew, and whose first names she did not bother to scribble on the back of the photo. Emma was the sort of woman about whom people would say, even years later, that she had been a real beauty. As she aged, she remained thin and stylish, even as my grandmother became shorter and rounder, her face and arms taking on a doughy softness. Only in the end, after Emma's mastectomy and the 6-year fight with cancer, after the institutionalization and the electroshock therapy, did she lose her luster, her beauty falling away from her, as did her mind. But by then, we were no longer receiving letters or pictures. My friend, who is a sculptor, tells me the practice of crazing in ceramics involves exposing a clay sculpture to extremes of temperature by putting it through the firing and cooling phases too quickly. The result is that the thin outside glaze contracts at a different rate than the larger, stable clay body underneath, and the result is an intricate, web-like pattern of hair-like fractures that appear on the surface. The effect in a clay pot is beautiful, a kind of distressed perfection. But what about such surface fractures when they appear in a person? People who knew Emma as a young woman described her as nervous, high-strung, particular, and not quite right, indicating a youthful sensitivity. It causes me to wonder if an already fragile mind, when exposed to severe shocks and extremes, is more vulnerable to crazing. As a child, I had superstitious ideas about what had caused Emma's mental illness. Could California, that wild place, have driven her insane? My father used to say that long ago the continent was tipped on its side, and whatever wasn't nailed down ended up in California. Poor Emma had ended up in California, with all the other flotsam and jetsam. Her younger brother, Adolf, my grandmother's living brother, writes me a letter in answer to my questions about Emma. Of course, it was a long time ago, he explains, his hand shaky and illegible. But he vaguely remembers that Emma survived a boating accident on the Sacramento River, in which both her fiancé and her best friend drowned. What must it be like to be orphaned of your mother at 10? To fight your way out of rurality and poverty into paradise, where you attract new friends and someone who loves you, only to lose everything again in one afternoon. "That river," Adolf writes, "I don't know why they went near it. Every year someone drowned in that spot, and still the people keep going." But even this makes sense to me. Of course Emma would go to that river, find the location of the most swirling, dangerous currents again and again. We are all drawn to that deep, downturning place that wants to pull us under. But without her mother, or another woman to tell her the story about what happens to the little girl who goes too close to the cliff, the little girl who wanders too far into the forest, the little girl who doesn't know to look for the wolf's whiskers under the grandmother's sleep bonnet, what chance would any of us have of surviving? The Jungian psychotherapist Naomi Ruth Lewinsky wrote about the mother line, that feminine lineage, the successive generations of women in a family who believe in you well before you exist and remember you long after you are gone. A rupture in the mother line, Lewinsky observed, has serious ramifications, which include the loss of family knowledge, stories, recipes, culture, and a sense of one's place in the family line. Without the strong feminine presence to tack us to our family, Lewinsky wrote, we might wander like motherless children in the too bright light of masculine consciousness. I see Emma in those words as I read them, just as I see myself, the young woman growing up in the 1970s, so anxious to leave home, so eager to unstring myself from the line of women in my family, their foolish cautions and stern reprimands, so hungry for reinvention. I see myself in Emma's vanity and extravagance, a woman who uses her body for fashion and recreation, for her own pleasure and the pleasure of men who are not good for her, men she barely knows. Where are my grandmothers? Virginia Woolf cried for her lost literary foremothers, their ancient texts buried deep and unrecovered. I grieve for my grandmothers who died too soon, or died without talking about such things, or died unheard because I wasn't listening. I think most of my two great-grandmothers who died in childbirth as I stand at this precipice, in my 40s and without children, terrified my whole life of taking my body into that dark cave of childbearing, from which I've seen women emerge either rich with child or broken beyond repair, but emerge nevertheless forever altered. The survivor woman in me, who knows how to find food, make herself useful, attract mates, and win fistfights, the hunted girl who is quick with her hands and feet, good at being a moving target, impossible to hit, has never dared to enter that dark cave of making. There's a moment in childbirth when no amount of breathing helps, the poet Norita Dixbrunner-Jax wrote. When you finally understand that you are the subject of your own life and your situation is serious. I think of my grandmother, Lydia Geist, delivering all three of her children in that small bedroom on the farmstead in central North Dakota, where her own mother died young, and where so many things went wrong. What kind of strength does it require to go to that bed each night, sleep, make love, and try to bear more children? My mother tells and doesn't tell the story of what happened to her two lost brothers. She infers and sighs, tells it in fragments as if I already know the full shape of the story no one has told me. They should have gone for the doctor, she says, but you know how poor they were. The first baby boy died of influenza 2 months after being born. A few years later, the next boy was born, his arm and collarbone broken, his eyes blackened from the brutality of extraction. He died the next day. No one ever talked about how my grandmother managed to rise up from that bed where she must have been broken as severely as her child. How did she bind together the torn and bloody parts of herself without a doctor and assume the care of her one living child, my mother, who was 4 at the time? No one ever talks about how Grandma Geist went back to her farm work, milking cows and shocking grain into tall sheaves. There are many stories of women who did not rise from these beds, but hers is not one of them. She who saw no importance in her own story. She who lives inside us now, like a shimmering web, catching us, keeping us right. Chapter 7. Between Earth and Sky. As I get older, I become infinitely interested in everything older than I am. Old people, old letters, photographs and papers, ship manifests, yellowed newspapers, crispy deeds, buried archives. For years, no trip home to see my parents seemed complete without a visit to an older cousin's house to ask questions about the old days, or to an old folks' home, or to an abandoned cemetery. On Memorial Day 1994, while visiting my parents, I went with my mother to place flowers on the family graves. My mother pointed out the double plot that she and my father had recently purchased. It surprised me that they had chosen a spot toward the center of the graveyard, close to the 15-foot statue of Jesus hanging on the cross. All the other family graves are located in the front row, facing the highway. Driving into town, one can see my surname repeated on the tall headstones. Marquardt, 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 Marquardt. "We thought it would be nicer in this spot," my mother said, pointing out the plot's proximity to the suffering Jesus. She was on her hands and knees, weeding crabgrass from what would someday be her own grave. "Visit us." She turned and looked up. Vertigo overtook me, the sound of water rushing through my eardrums. "Excuse me?" I said, afraid to hear it again. "After we're gone," she said, returning to her weeding. "Don't forget to visit us." When we got back to the house, I asked my father about great-grandma Marquardt. I hadn't seen her name among the headstones. "She's buried," my father explained, "near Hague, a town 60 miles south, near the place where my great-grandfather originally took up a land claim when he arrived in the United States. After great-grandmother died, he remarried a widow, another immigrant from the villages, and moved both families north to Napoleon, buying the farm our family now owns. So great-grandpa Marquardt is buried here, with his second wife." That night, I asked my father to show me where the first great-grandma is buried, and we agreed to head out early the next day. I suddenly felt sad for her, buried somewhere south of there, alone in a land that must never have ceased to be strange and unfamiliar to her. It seemed important that someone from my generation know where to find her, although I'm not sure what would compel such a need. I've often wondered why great-grandpa sold off his original land claim in McIntosh County and bought the larger property where I grew up in Logan County. Was the land so much better? Were the memories of my great-grandmother too acutely tied to the original homestead for him to bear staying there? Impossible to know. People didn't talk about such things back then, and anyone he may have confided in would be long dead. The house that great-grandpa built on the original homestead in McIntosh County is still there, my father told me. It's ensconced inside several additions and renovations, but two of the original outer walls can still be seen. My father wanted to show me the site, and, if possible, he wanted to introduce me to the family that bought the land from my great-grandfather in 1900. We almost didn't get out of the house the next morning because my mother discovered that Sector C, the southwestern quadrant of her sprinkler system, was not functioning. Although we only planned to be gone for about 6 hours, my mother didn't like the idea of leaving home when anything was out of kilter. It was only 7 a.m., but already she had called the repairman who lives 2 blocks away in our 10-block town. He promised to come and fix it, but she really wanted to be there when he arrived. Then my father started fiddling with the master controls, the dials, and the timer clock housed in the garage, which made it even more certain that we wouldn't get out the door that day. As my parents got older, I tried to make it home at least twice a year to visit, usually at Christmas and sometime during the summer. Teaching at a university 2 states away made it even harder for me to keep up with their interests, which seemed to dwindle in number, but occupied increasingly larger amounts of their time and energy. When he was alive, my father insisted on going to the post office by 8:05 a.m. to pick up the mail the moment it hit the box, or the day would be ruined. My mother continues to hold a part-time job cleaning the church. The town that felt so small to me growing up seemed to shrink even more as my parents aged. My life, conversely, branched out to new places, spreading farther and wider. As it did so, it grew more abstract and difficult for my parents to comprehend. They could so little imagine the quality of my days, who my friends were, how I made my living, that they would have trouble formulating the first question. Before I called them, I'd try to turn myself back into the person they remembered as their daughter. There's a story that goes around in my family that my paternal great-grandmother, Barbara Holm Marquardt, upon seeing the strip of land in central North Dakota that she had traveled from South Russia by boat, rail, then oxen, to claim in 1885, fell to the ground and cried, "It's all earth and sky." I'm told it sounded better in German. "Das ist ja alles Himmel und Erde." And I don't doubt it. Growing up as a grandchild of immigrants in a small town populated largely by ethnic Germans who had fled Russia, I was constantly reminded that everything sounded more clever or grave, more funny or profound, when uttered in the mother tongue. Perhaps my grandmother responded to the treeless, unbroken plain of grassland in much the way as did Berit, the Norwegian pioneer woman in Ole Rolfag's classic novel of immigrant experience, Giants in the Earth. All along the way, coming out, she had noticed this strange thing. The stillness had grown deeper, the silence more depressing. She realized it had been weeks since she'd heard a bird sing. In Giants in the Earth, Barrett grew to pathologically fear the expanse of the plains. She described it as a bluish-green infinity in which there was no place to hide. When another pioneer caravan passed through and pressed deeper into the unimaginable void, Barrett watched the settlers' wagons as they grew small on the horizon and disappeared under the brow of heaven. But whether into the earth or into the sky, she thought, no one could tell. What Barrett must have sensed was missing in that expanse of green and blue, and what my great-grandmother may have instinctively feared, was that missing sliver, a small margin of culture necessary in the landscape for survival. Not a culture of opera or ballet, but a culture of potatoes and onions, pots and pans, doilies, curtains, and bed linens, in which children could be fed and sheltered. And into that negative space my great-grandmother must have known, she would be expected to pour her days and nights, the work of her hands, and all of her imagination to bring shape to these things. On the journey across the country, my great-grandmother was pregnant, as was the character Beret in Giants in the Earth. On the wagon, as they approached their land, Beret's husband, Per Hansa, thought about his wife's condition. Beret was going to have a baby again, only a blessing, of course, but what a lot of their time it would take up just now. Oh, well, she would have to bear the brunt of it herself, as the woman usually did. I remember these lines even though I read the novel almost 20 years ago. I find them easily because they are underlined, and I understand as I read them again that I have been looking for my grandmother's for a long time, searching deep in the crevices of old maps and books for them. Genealogies are never enough. How sad to think of a whole life reduced to these dry facts, birth and death, marriage dates, the inadequate words wife or mother, chiseled on a tombstone in a graveyard no one knows to visit. My great-grandmother Marquardt did not last long in America. She died in childbirth in February 1900, 15 years after her arrival, attempting to deliver her 11th child, a daughter who would die with her on that day. I have nothing tangible with which to gauge the quality of her life. No photographs, no worn thin wedding bands, no engraved silver platters. Only this single line she is known to have uttered at perhaps the most desperate moment of her life. I learned the barest bones of her story from my father's first cousin, Tony, who remembered better the older generation. His father died in the influenza epidemic of 1918 within a week of Tony's birth, so he was taken back into my great-grandfather's house and raised there. He remembers his grandparents as vividly as most children would remember their parents. On an earlier visit home from my teaching job, I called up Tony and asked him if I could stop by and ask some questions about the older generation. Soon I found myself sitting at the round oak table in Tony's big kitchen, listening to him talk about great-grandma and great-grandpa. My father came along to ask his own questions and to hear Tony's answers. Both men were in their 70s, but they looked remarkably young, as the men in my family tend to. They were both short with very slight builds, and their facial features, like mine, when viewed from certain angles, looked slightly Asiatic. But what I noticed most as I sat listening to Tony is how much our hands were alike. Small hands with a long, narrow palm and a well-shaped thumb. Although Tony was missing a joint on his left middle finger from what, I assumed, was most likely a farm accident. And what struck me even more that day was how much our gestures were alike. As we talked, we all placed our hands on the table in front of us, fingers clasped together in the shape of a pyramid. Most of my adult life, I have lived out in the world in cities and university towns with men and women from every conceivable part of the world. So the sight of so many small hands shaped like my own on the table before me was stunning. For that moment, I saw my hands as part of an ongoing chain of hands, no longer mine, free to do whatever they pleased, but bound to my ancestors by blood, mannerism, and duty. As the only writer in my family and the first generation to attend college, I checked my palms and thought, these are the hands I was given to write with. Now what is there for me to do with them? And this is an excellent place for us to finish our reading today of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. who is a professor at Iowa State University and the coordinator of the creative writing program there. You have been listening to this book on KHOI's Community Bookshelf. Producer Mary Richards, assistant producer Janet Kloss, chief engineer Rick Morrison, and program engineer Ron Latson. You can hear this program every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. This is Mary Richards. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening.